Welcome to the Zesty Garden. In the past 10 years, allergy and asthma rates have continued to increase dramatically around the world. An estimated 50 million Americans, or 1 in 5, suffer from asthma and allergies, more than diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's. For the millions of people with allergies or asthma, The Allergy Fighting Garden, a book by Thomas Leo Ogren, shows how to avoid plants that trigger allergies and to create a garden that will actually protect you by trapping pollen and cleaning the air around you. Mr. Ogren's system for combating allergens is based on the fact that only male plants, which are overplanted in gardens and civic landscapes, produce huge amounts of pollen. By replacing these troublesome male plants in your yard with pollen-trapping female pollen screens, allergy sufferers can reduce or eliminate their symptoms. Mr. Ogren is essentially a horticultural epidemiologist researching the connections between human health and the planted urban landscape. He has an MS degree in agriculture horticulture with an emphasis on plant flowering systems. He's the creator of Opals, the world's first numerical plant allergy scale, and he's on the line with us from California. Thank you for joining me on the program today, Mr. Ogren.
Good morning, Brian. Great to be here.
So the first thing I thought of when I was reading your book was, All right, so for the last 40 to 50 years, we've been told plant male trees. And and things are better. They're much cleaner. They're not nearly as messy as females. But you're saying we should be going the opposite direction?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. Okay, so we start out, you're talking about the epidemic of allergy and asthma, which is totally real. 50 years ago, there was like 2 to 5% of the public that had it. It's now, some estimates are as high as 40% or higher in the United States. 50% of some of the kids have allergies in the UK now. At any rate, it's an urban phenomenon. It's not happening in the country. It's happening in the cities where we've got a lot of pollution. And what's happening is that the air pollution is combining with increased amounts of pollen from all these male plants. And it's a very bad situation, and it's coming home to roost, and it's been going on now for quite a bit. But they are trying to clean up the air pollution, and they're not doing that great a job of it because there's so many cars on the road. We in horticulture can do our part by we can start planting the opposite of what we've been doing. We can start planting female plants that actually trap some pollen out of the air. There's monoecious plants like oaks and pine trees and so on that are shed a lot of pollen, and they are not single sex. They have both sexes on them. But, and they're also part of the problem, although not the pines. But with these monoecious plants that have both sexes on them, there was a USDA yearbook, not yearbook, but a pamphlet that came out in 1980 or something, and it was how to produce all male plants from monoecious species. And so since the 80s, we've got a lot of plants that in nature always have male and female on them. But now when you buy them in a nursery, they're just male. And in my area, I'm in California right now, if I buy an Italian cypress tree from seed, these things have male and female cones at the top. But the ones that sell now are grown from cuttings, and the cuttings only came from the male part. So these things are now male top to bottom, and as a result, they're much, much more allergenic than they used to be. But, it's become quite a huge problem.
You also talk about how trees absorb pollution, but how female trees would be better for us with regards to that. Why is that?
All right. So there's now data that links increases in breast cancer and ovarian cancer and leukemia in women, but not men, who have pollen allergies. And so if you think about this in this way, the whole allergy phenomena, even with the food allergy and everything, is this urban phenomena where we've got all these freeways and all these traffic jams and all this air pollution. And so we plant trees for shade and to clean up the air, which they do. The trees are very absorbent creatures, and they absorb all these different chemicals. There's at least 1,000 or more chemicals that are in our pollutant soup that are, well, what they call estrogen mimickers or androgen mimickers. They're hormonal disrupting agents is what they are. And some of them are called like xenoestrogens, super estrogens, if you will, chemical versions. And these things get into the trees, and then, okay, picture this. You've got a big shade tree in the city, and you've got people like eat underneath of it and picnic or whatever. Now, if that tree is female, say it's an ash tree, it drops these messy seeds on the ground, and then after a while they rake them up and throw them away, and nothing happened. But if the same tree was a male tree and it produced literally billions of grains of pollen, now the pollen off of that polluted tree that is polluted because it's cleaning up all that pollution out of the air and the soil and the water, all that same pollution is coming back through the pollen, and now that pollution is coming back in a little tiny 20 micron sized, easily inhalable form, pollen grains. And so people are now getting that same pollution back in the form of pollen. And, well, all I'm saying is this is not a healthy situation to keep doing this. We have to make changes. Our children are important. Our women are important. We're important. It's not that huge of a thing to plant something female and sweep up some seeds and not have to inhale that kind of pollution. You following me, Brian?
Yes.
On that?
So you had an interesting point in the book about how pollen, I always thought, well, it just flies throughout the air and travels a long way, but you're saying that most of it actually falls within the tree's drip line.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I could send you a photo of different photos I've taken of trees where you can see, because the pollen is fairly yellow, exactly where the pollen is falling. And sometimes you'll notice when you're walking down a sidewalk in a street, you'll see pollen all over, maybe 40, 50 feet of sidewalk, and then it peters out right away. And that's because most of the pollen is affected by gravity, same as everything else. And every species of pollen has a different specific gravity. So some of it is much heavier than others, but regardless of how heavy or light it is, all the pollen generally falls out and sticks quite close to the source. Now, wind can come by and pick that pollen up and so on and move it further, but the first biggest heavy exposure to pollen is always very close to the plant that's shedding the pollen, and they call this proximity pollinosis, which is interpreted to the closer you are to the source of that pollen, the greater is your exposure. And the difference between exposure means like it's dose relevant. So it's like, say you had a headache, Brian, and you took 2 aspirin, you'd probably feel better. But if you had a headache and you took 30 aspirin, you're not going to feel better. You're going to be worse. And it's the same with pollen. It's not bad for us to get small doses of pollen. These things charge up our immune system. When I do landscaping, I always use flowering plants that produce seed pods or berries or something, but that also produce a little bit of pollen, because a little bit of pollen is good for us. What's not good for us is these huge overexposures, particularly to this heavily urbanized, polluted pollen, and that's the crux of that, I think.
You talk about in the book about folks having a bucket, and
yes.
Each bucket depends how big it is depends on the person, of course, and that some
yes.
of that could be genetics. I don't know what else would play into that. I don't personally have any allergies that I know of. But my father, it's especially has just my whole life. I remember him sneezing and having issues, and a lot of that
yeah.
was triggered. I mean, he grew up here in Utah, but when we moved, he was in the military. We moved to Texas. It was after
yeah.
he got exposed all of a sudden to all of these. I'm guessing all of these other pollens that all of a sudden it triggered his allergies.
Right. In Texas, they've got a crazy situation. They've got a type of juniper tree that grows all around a large area of Texas, and it's separate sexed, and the males produce a lot of pollen. And talking over the years with people who are familiar with the loggers who cut that stuff, they call ashy junipers, but anyhow, or down there they call them cedar, but it is a juniper. And the guys that cut the stuff for firewood and for lumber, they use it for paneling, they've found that when they go start chainsawing a tree that doesn't have any berries on it, juniper berries, that they start getting sick. Well, what's happening is they're cutting on a male tree, it's releasing pollen all over them, and then they start getting sick. So as a result, and this has also happened in New Mexico and east parts of eastern Arizona, these guys logging this stuff have been systematically going and cutting down the trees that have the juniper berries on it. That means that they've been chopping down the female trees and leaving the males. And so even out there in this supposedly wild natural setup situation, we don't have any balance of the sexes. We've got too many males, not enough females, and the female's job of any species of tree is to trap pollen from the male and turn it into seeds. So your father was probably heavily overexposed to that juniper pollen down there, and if you get exposed enough, then you get the allergy triggered, and then once you've got the allergy triggered, then you've got it pretty much, and then you've got all the problems that come with it. And if you get a very bad allergy like your father had or something, then your chances are more than double of getting asthma. And asthma is the number one chronic disease of children in America now. And when I go to landscapes I systematically do this, and I go to look at landscapes at elementary schools, and the highest pollen count ever recorded in the entire United States was taken off the top of an elementary school in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I went and I visited that place, and there were 24 mature shade trees there, and of the 24, 23 were male clones. And to me, that's just scandalous. It makes no sense at all.
Well, about 10 years ago, I remember being at my parents' home, and their ponderosa there was pollen all over the place, and my dad would try to avoid it. And I remember going up to the branch and said, "Look, Dad, look what I can do." And I shook the branch and breathed in the pollen. So what I'm hearing you say is, well, that may have not filled my bucket that day, but I don't want to push my luck. Eventually,
And I didn't even answer your question about the bucket, but sure, you have a very large bucket, and some people's bucket is bigger than others. But the idea is, and the bucket theory, and I've heard I heard one allergist describe it recently as a bathtub theory as opposed to a bucket. But the point is that you can be exposed to dozens and dozens of different potential allergens in a day, and each one that goes in fills your bucket closer to the top. But as long as your bucket's still got some room in it, you're symptom-free. You feel good. And the trick is not to let your bucket get to where it overflows. Once it overflows, you get symptomatic. Then you start sneezing. Then you get feeling bad. Then you have all these different hundreds of possible symptoms that come from allergies. There's been a huge amount of people in the United States this year that have gone on and coughed for like a couple of months, and it seemed like they had these colds that wouldn't go away. Awful lot of that was just allergies to the trees blooming. But as long as you don't overflow your bucket, you're all right. And what does that mean? That means, like, say you've got several allergenic plants in your yard, and you remove them and replace them with something that's allergy-fighting, allergy-friendly. If you do that, you're reducing your own exposure. Now, you may get exposed to a lot of other things, but as long as your bucket doesn't overflow, you still feel good. And as long as you are symptom-free, as long as you feel good, that's wonderful. I mean, that's really is our aim. It's I'm not ever talking about curing asthma or allergies. I don't believe there are any cures for them other than avoidance, and avoidance is what we're trying to do, particularly with children. Children should not be going to schools that are landscaped with lots and lots of highly allergenic plants, and yet that is terribly typical. For some reason, I guess they didn't want the children to pull seeds or fruits or berries or pods or something off of plants that make them, and maybe they'd throw them at each other. So they sort of systematically made these landscapes at schools very sterile, if you would.
Well, we have about 15 minutes left in the program. If, as a listener, you'd like to call in with a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. I'm talking with Thomas Leo Ogren. He is a developer of the OPALS system. It's a numerical plant allergy scale, and he has an MS degree in agriculture, horticulture, and is a horticultural epidemiologist. Again, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Mr. Ogren is the author of The Allergy Fighting Garden. It's from 10 Speed Press, which is a company of Penguin Random House, and we're talking about that book. So how do you know if you've got male or female trees?
Well,
or plants at all?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is if your tree doesn't drop any seeds on the ground, there's probably a reason. If it never drops any seed pods or cones or anything like that, there is a reason with that, probably because it's male. There are literally hundreds of millions of male clonal trees out there in the United States now. The USDA released hundreds of them themselves. Almost every single poplar tree and cottonwood tree and willow tree, ash tree, it goes on and on, sold in the last 20, 30 years, has been a male clone. Some of these of the best plants are very difficult to find, and you have to know the precise name of them. And perhaps the best thing in the Allergy Fighting Garden is that there's some 3,000-plus plants that are allergy-ranked 1 to 10 with OPAL system, and that the exact names of the allergy-fighting, allergy-friendly clones are in that book, and the exact names of the very worst, most allergenic cultivars, clones, whatever you call them, are also listed. So a lot of people tell me that they take the book to the nursery with them, and that after they've had my book for a while, it gets pretty beat up. But they're using the book as a tool. Something I'd like to mention, if just because it's so topical right now, is in a few days, well, next week, May 5th, I'm giving a Google talk at Google. And so I went up there a couple weeks ago, and I looked at the landscape, and I went around and took this big tour, rode the Google bicycle and everything, and I looked at the landscaping at Google. A lot of people were having allergies that worked there, and there was a lot of pollen around and a lot of male trees. For example, that looked like they had recently planted several hundred Chinese passage trees, and they were all grafted males, and all the ash trees that had been planted in the last, oh, I don't know, a couple decades, they were all male. And so at this talk, I'm going to challenge Google. I'm going to issue a call to action, if you will, for them to re-landscape the Google campus so that it's a shining example of an allergy-friendly place. And that's becoming more and more what I'm interested in now is I feel like I've been talking about this and writing about it long enough almost that it's time for some action. I'm looking for cities and school boards and counties to do something. There have been a lot of individual people who have done their own yards, which is a wonderful idea. But I'm looking to see public health departments and so on do it. The state of California has now got language in their most recent thing coming out of their asthma initiative that we should put a ban on the most allergenic of these male trees and shrubs, and that all of the public spaces, and particularly the hospitals and schools, should be landscaped to be allergy friendly. But they've got the language, but I'm looking for some action. I'm hoping to that my work makes a real difference. We're talking millions of people being affected, and there is a something that we can do about it, and that's what I'm hoping to have. I want some action, you know.
Sure. Well, so what I'm hearing then is that the three 130-foot cottonwoods across the street that just spit out seeds like crazy, I should be grateful for those and that they're not the
others. Yes, absolutely. Those are cleaning the air there. They are totally cleaning the air. And people confuse the cottonwood flying with cotton coming from a female tree, which was probably a seedling or something. And that cottonwood is often flying the fluff. In Russia, they call it pook. But that cotton is flying at the same time. There's all sorts of other pollen around that's also flying around. And if people sneeze, they'll look at that because it's large enough they can see it, and they'll blame that for their allergies. But that's not what's causing the allergies. The cotton is seed, and it used to be a lot more cotton around when I was a kid because it used to be a fairly popular tree was Salix babylonica, the old standard weeping willow tree, mm-hmm. and it was a female clone. But it's been replaced almost everywhere by a male clone that they call golden willow, weeping willow or something, and it just produces more pollen. But when you see that stuff, be grateful.
there's about a week and a half out of every year that I just want to curse this stuff because it's just all over the place. But so it's good to hear this other side of it, so I know that it's doing some good and not just irritating me.
So, no, it is doing good, and every single little tiny piece of fluff that you see represents a pollinated ovary. In other words, one grain of pollen was pulled out of the air and brought to that female tree by mutual attraction and turned into a seed. And that means every little bit of that fluff represents pollen grains that are no longer out there floating around making people sick or sitting around. I don't know if you read that section on mutual attraction, but
yeah, it was fascinating. I didn't know that.
So, well, a female tree has its roots in the ground, and she is grounded, and her millions of little tiny flowers with their little feathery stigmas, they are slightly sticky, and they give off a negative electrical impulse. Now, pollen grains get into the air, and these separate sex species, this happens, and they tumble about in the air, and they pick up a positive electrical charge. When you have positive and negative, you have what's called mutual attraction, and that pollen is actually drawn to those female flowers by this mutual attraction. Mother Nature, very clever. The pollen didn't get to that female just by accident. It was drawn there. And it's a very effective system, and hence the name of this book, The Allergy Fighting Garden. These female plants are fighting back. They are not just passive. I mean, a female plant produces no pollen. That in itself would be good enough reason to use it. But even better, the female plant with all these little flowers and this mutual attraction going on, they pull the pollen out of the air and bring it to it, and then they convert it to seed. So these are allergy fighting plants, and the more of those we plant, the cleaner the air will be in our immediate area.
I would also advocate having a diversity in the landscape. For instance, I have a Fort McNair horse chestnut female,
yes.
And there aren't any other chestnuts in the neighborhood. And it's been blossoming for about the 8 years, these beautiful pink blossoms, but I don't get any chestnuts because there's not another male chestnut in the neighborhood.
Ah, okay, right. You can tell by how far a pollen grain will go by, like, okay, for example, where I am, there's these tall Phoenix palm trees, similar to date palms, like Canary Island date palms. And I know of one that's sitting out in the middle of a farmer's field, and the nearest one to it is the nearest male is at least a quarter of a mile away. And yet that one solitary tree always, which is a female, always still makes a big crop of dates on it. Now what that tells me is, one, that date pollen will travel further than most, and two, that the pollen trapping power of that particular female tree is powerful. And even though it's isolated like it is, it's still pulling that date pollen out of the air very effectively. All that differs with species to species.
And some could be pollinated by insects versus being wind carried.
Right, and you will read sometimes, or many times, I guess, that they'll write that anything that's pollinated by insects doesn't cause allergies or asthma, but that's not true. And the first plant that ever set me off on this hunt 30-some years ago was a bottle brush. And when people take a direct sniff of bottle brush, for example, your father, who is what they call atopic, meaning he already has allergies, or someone who's susceptible to it, they took one sniff of that and they started sneezing so bad it was amazing. And there are other types of pollens that are from insect-pollinated plants that in sniff tests, I've seen it just literally blow people away. And so pretty much every plant has to be evaluated on a plant-by-plant basis. For example, you take a very common plant like privet. Privet's in the olive family, and there's a lot of allergenic plants in that family. And if you look at privet flowers, you'll see a lot of bees and flies visiting privet flowers. So people would say, oh, privet's it's insect pollinated, it won't cause a problem, but that's not necessarily true. And so the privet pollen will cause a problem, and some of it is insect pollinated, but some of it is called amphipolis. Some of it is pollinated by the wind, and so you have plants that are pollinated by both insects and the wind, and these plants can be a problem too. There is a new clone now of privet that doesn't flower at all, quite attractive. I can't think of the name of it. It's in the book, but because it's not producing any pollen, it doesn't produce the problem.
Well, but I want to make sure that we cover the opal system. Tell me what the opal system is and how this book integrates with that.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. Opal stands for Ogren Plant Allergy Scale, and Ogren is my last name. And when I created the scale, it's been over 20 years now that I started it, I was told to put my name into the scale as a way of protecting it and as an intellectual property, because I first published the scale 16, 17 years ago, and the first people to use it were the USDA urban foresters in New York. But the scale uses a potential 137 different criteria. And I take any one plant, and it takes a considerable amount of time, and I explore the plant and examine the plant. I have to look at the plant when it's flowering and so on. And I ask all these questions, and each question gets a positive or a negative. And so questions would be like, how allergenic is that pollen on a grain-per-grain basis compared to other pollen? How large is the pollen? How sticky is the pollen, or how dry is the pollen? A question would be, how long is that plant actually in bloom? A question would be, are the stamens, the pollen-bearing parts, are they exposed, exerted, or are they hidden, as in a snap snapdragon, which of course is much better if they're hidden. There are all these different criteria, and I number crunch it, and I come up with an Opal's number, 1 to 10. 1 meaning allergy-free, not causing any allergies to anyone that we've ever seen, or 10, pretty much guaranteed problems. And so all of the plants in the book, like I said, over 3,000 different plants and cultivars are Opal's ranked. And that means every one of them has a number. So if you take a look at pansies or something. Now, pansy is not pollen-free, but the pollen grains are very large and sticky. There's not very many of them. It's totally insect-pollinated, and there's no data anywhere on anybody having allergies to it. It gets opals 1. Now, if you take a plant like, say, a male juniper clone, like you'd go down and buy at the nursery or something. A male juniper, pretty much, it's a 10. It has no redeeming qualities whatsoever when it comes to human health. All it does is produces huge amounts of pollen and it traps none. And then there are all these numbers in between because everything is not simple as cut and dry and all plants are not necessarily male or female. But opals, a lot of people use opals as a tool. So they start out, people trying to cocoon themselves nowadays, and they want to make their own yard something that won't make them or their wife or their husband or their children sick. And so people use the book, and they use the opal system. And the first thing they do typically is they look over the whole yard, and they see if there's anything already there that's super allergenic. And then they ask themselves, well, how badly do I want that shrub or whatever it is? And if they don't, if they're not totally in love with it or something, they dig it up and get rid of it, and then they plant something that they like that's allergy friendly to take its place. As soon as they do that, they make that yard a little bit healthier place. By the way, it's not always removing some of these trees. Some of these big trees, there's pruning systems now where we can prune them so that they don't bloom and produce the pollen. And
so you can take a male tree and turn it into a female tree, at least the top half.
Yes, I've done this with many fruitless mulberry trees. People didn't like the sound of that. Some people, I'm giving the trees a sex change, and but that's literally what I'm doing. I would take a pretty good sized fruitless mulberry tree and chainsaw it back to stubs that are 2, 3, 4 inches in diameter, and I'll cleft graft them with scion wood from a female fruiting tree, and they're fairly easy to graft, and all the grafts have come out. There'll be fruiting grafts, and everything behind the graft that pops a bud, because we do this when they're dormant, we'll rub it out, and boom, we've got, now we took a super, super allergenic tree, and we turned it into a fruiting female tree that makes mulberries and causes no allergies. In fact, a female mulberry tree will pull considerable amount of mulberry pollen right out of the air. So, I'm looking forward to the time that things are jumping enough that I'm able to go to cities and train like groups of people how to graft these male trees. It'd be much better if we could graft a lot of these trees rather than cutting them down or something, because trees are good. We need trees. Well, you know that. We need more canopy. And you were mentioning diversity, and I didn't pick up on that. But when I was at Google and I was looking at the landscape, I would see like whole blocks were lined with the exact same type of tree. And if the tree was producing pollen in like several blocks, nothing but sweet gum trees, liquid ambers. Well, they produce a certain amount of pollen. They are monaceous, and the pollen was all over the sidewalks. And by not putting diversity in there, they overexpose whoever is working in that area. I would go to a parking lot, and there'd be 300 trees in a big parking lot, and every one of them would be a clonal ash tree, say. In other words, again, no diversity. And you know, a lot of us in horticulture and landscaping, we've been guilty in the past of of not being very diverse, of not using enough. You know, horticulture is a wonderful thing. There are so many hundreds of thousands, all these different plants we could use, and yet typically people are not putting enough imagination into their landscaping. There's so many different bushes and trees we could use for these foundation plants and so on, and yet you go to a city and it looks like everybody uses the same dozen plants over and over. You know what I mean?
Yes, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But you've been listening.
Oh, okay.
So there's lots to talk about, but I really appreciate you to come on the program. It's The Zesty Garden, and I've been talking with Thomas Leo Ogren. He's the author of The Allergy-Fighting Garden. Thank you for joining me on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's wonderful.
Coming up next, you're going to hear a little bit more of the program, and we'll end with Petals and Prose, so stay tuned. Welcome to this segment of Going Native. I'm with Jeanette Warner, and she's owner of Wildland Nursery just south of Richfield in Joseph. And today we're going to talk about the Eriogonum umbellatum, or sulfur flower. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
Excellent. Well, this is another one I think I'm familiar with, but why don't you tell me a little bit about it?
It's the most common Eriogonum, or buckwheat. It's a buckwheat in the nursery trade. And it's so popular because it's showy year-round. The flowers are just a bright sulfur yellow, really pretty, very attractive. And then the leaves are shiny and really cute, and they spread and make a good ground cover, especially on a rocky, dry, hilly slope.
Oh, okay. I hadn't thought of these as being a ground cover. So how large will they spread on their own?
Oh, wow. I was really surprised. We have a native plant garden at the museum, the Fremont Indian Museum, and they are spreading. And I was so surprised. Some of them are 3 feet across. And when they're blooming, it's just this mass, bright yellow hillside.
And how long do they bloom?
With a little additional water, easily over a month.
So if you had an area, and I get this question quite a bit, is what would you recommend for a dry, slopey area? This would be one that you could use for that.
Right. Very well.
Now, if it gets a little extra water, can you kill it with too much water?
You might if you flooded it, but I think it would be quite a bit of water before it would kill it.
Now, you have this listed as evergreen, so it has some year-round interest to it.
That's right. Except what's really cool about it, in the wintertime when it gets cold, the leaves turn red. And so you have this really cool-looking red plant growing in the wintertime. And where I'm at, where we don't have snow cover, we need a lot of interest in the wintertime.
So if we do have snow cover, will that hurt the plant at all?
It just insulates it.
Okay.
Right.
And you have also down that it's pollinator friendly.
Oh, yes. The bees, anything, seems like anything yellow, the bees are just really go for it. And I see the butterflies around it, too. I have a lot of butterflies in my yard.
And how long do the flowers last again?
At least a month.
And into what, July? Or
it's
earlier?
A midsummer. It's a midsummer.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is the balls of yellow flowers in July and August. Seed heads turn rust-colored and persist through the fall. So how large are the seed heads?
They're just the flowers are maybe an inch to an inch and a half, and big clusters of these flowers. Like umbellatum means umbrella-shaped, and so these flowers are on top of this umbrella-type organization or whatever.
This is also desirable. It's long-lived.
Yes.
Some of the natives, sometimes they peter out after a few years, but this one.
No, I've had mine in my yard in that same place for like 8 years, and at our garden at the museum, it's just going crazy. And the ones that we originally planted are still going strong 7-8 years later. And is that long-lived? What is long-lived?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, okay.
And you've got full sun and part shade.
Right.
So in my dry, shaded area, I could put this on the edge
right.
of it.
Right, uh-huh. This grows at little higher elevations, like at the foothill of the Boulder Mountains. And it's in shade there underneath the Quakeys, underneath the Gamble Oak.
And it says zones 3 to 6.
Right.
So that's good. Medium to low water.
Right.
and you've already mentioned Fabulous and Rock Gardens. What would you pair it with?
Well, I like to try to grow things together that they're blooming at the same time. And my Zoschinaria is blooming now, and this it's really, really nice with this buckwheat.
And what is a Zoschinaria? I like that it starts with a Z in the first place, but
it's a red, beautiful red ground cover wreath. Orange carpet is another name for it. Fire chalice.
Okay, and also you have it with thick leaf penstemon.
I like the thick leaf penstemon. It bloomed. The thick leaf penstemon blooms a lot earlier in the summer, but the leaves, the gray leaves of the penstemon next to the green leaves of the areogonum is pretty.
Now, typically, do you plant natives that flower at the same time together, or do you intersperse them throughout your garden?
Both, because like the Zoschinaria, the fire chalice, blooms the same time as the Blumis spirea. And they both like that same garden site, full sun, dry, gravelly garden area. And so you've got the fire chalice that is low ground covery, and then the real pretty blue Caryopsis, the Blumis spirea, which isn't a native, but it's a fabulous plant.
Because it does really well.
It does fabulous, yes. And so they bloom at the same time, and they're just striking together.
They have those two colors.
To have. And now and then that little bit of yellow from the buckwheat pops in there.
Now, does the sulfur flower that we've been talking about, does it reseed?
Yes. Not invasively by any means. It's just the one you want. Okay, please come up there.
Is that how it propagates itself, is through seed or
division?
Uh-huh.
At our garden at the museum, it is propagated by seed. Most nursery production is from vegetative cuttings, division.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about I'm going to say this wrong again. You say it.
Areogonum
umbellatum, or the sulfur flower.
Buckwheat.
Or buckwheat. And this one's pretty readily available.
It is available,
I've seen this in quite a few places. And you've been listening to Going Native. It's our segment on native and drought-tolerant plants. Jeanette Warner is owner of Wildland Nursery, which is just south of Richfield in Joseph. And we'll have her on again in a few weeks. Thanks, Jeanette.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams here for Petals and Prose, and I'm continuing some readings from Terry Tempest Williams' book, Refuge, which was published when the Great Salt Lake was at its historic high levels and the state was trying to figure out what to do about the flooding. At the same time, Terry's mother was battling ovarian cancer, and Terry chronicles how her family, disrupted by that disease, tried to hold itself together, and at the same time how the state of Utah tried to hold itself together against the threat of the rising salt lake. This is her chapter called Snow Buntings, when the lake level was 4,209 feet. The eastern shore of Great Salt Lake is frozen, and as far as I can see, it translates into isolation, desolation. The fog hangs low with little delineation between earth and sky, a few ravens, a few eagles, and the implacable wind. Snow crystals stand on the land like the raised hackles of wolves. Broken reeds and cattails are encased in ice. Great Salt Lake has not only entered the marsh, it has taken over. Because of the high water level and the drop in salinity, Great Salt Lake can freeze, and does. The transparent ice along the lake's edge is filled with bubbles of air trapped inside like the sustained notes of a soprano. I walk these open spaces in silence, relishing the monotony of the refuge in winter. Perhaps I'm here because of last night's dream, when I stood on the frozen lake before a kayak made of sealskin. I walked on the ice toward the boat and picked up a handful of shredded hide and guts. An old Eskimo man said, "You have much to work with." Suddenly, the kayak was stripped of its skin. It was a rib cage of willow. It was the skeleton of a fish. I want to see it for myself. Wild exposure in January when this desert is most severe. The lake is like steel. I wrap my alpaca shawl tight around my face until only my eyes are exposed. I must keep walking to stay warm. Even the land is frozen. There is no give beneath my feet. I want to see the lake as woman, as myself, in her refusal to be tamed. The state of Utah may try to dike her, divert her waters, build roads across her shores, but ultimately it won't matter. She will survive us. I recognize her as a wilderness, raw and self-defined. Great Salt Lake strips me of contrivance and conditioning, saying, I am not what you see. Question me. Stand by your own impressions. We are taught not to trust our own experiences. Great Salt Lake teaches me experience is all we have. 1 month ago, this was frozen country, monochromatic and still. But this morning, spring has moved in. Constellations of ducks, pintails, mallards, widgeons, and teals are flying in from the south and southwest. The air is wild with voices. Avian dialects are being spoken from every direction. The sky vibrates with wings. Mother does not share my affection for birds. This is her first trip to Bear River. We watch a dozen herons fishing. Beyond them, I spot a carcass, a scattering of blue feathers and bones. I lure Mother forward. Up ahead, we find a wing. A great blue heron, I say, picking it up. The primary feathers are attached to the ulna like the teeth of a comb. Blood stains the snow. More bones, more feathers, and tracks. We bend down to get a closer look. What do you think? Asks Mother. Fox, maybe. I don't know. I think they're too small for a coyote. The wind blows, scattering the white downy feathers in all directions. They rest momentarily on the snow, rocking back and forth like cradles until they cartwheel off in the breeze. We walk west. Blue-winged teals congregate between greasewood. On the road adjacent to Great Salt Lake, huge compression fractures have heaved, diagonal chunks of ice this way and that. I try to climb over them, but they present too great an obstacle. They line the shore for miles. We can travel no farther. I want you to read, God sees the truth but waits, says Mother. Tolstoy writes about a man wrongly accused of a murder who spends the rest of his life in a prison camp. 26 years later, as a convict in Siberia, he meets the true murderer and has an opportunity to free himself, but chooses not to. His longing for home leaves him, and he dies. I ask Mother why this story matters to her. Each of us must face our own Siberia, she says. We must come to peace with our own isolation. No one can rescue us. My cancer is my Siberia. Suddenly, two white birds about the size of finches dart in front of us and land on the snow. I don't know these birds, Mother. They're something new. She hands me the bird book. I rapidly thumb through the pages. She's looking through the binoculars. They are white with black on their backs, and I see a flash of rust on their heads. She pauses. I can also see black on the tips of their wings when they fly. I quickly look up to see if they are gone, but they have just moved a few feet up the road, so I flip back through the book again. I found them. Here they are, page 412. Snow buntings. I hand the field guide to Mother, focusing on the birds to make sure. I can't believe it. I look at her and then back to the buntings. These are rare to the refuge. I've never seen them before. We watch them forage around the edges of melting snow. Mother brings down her binoculars. Where are they usually found? She asks, looking at the field guide once again, this time at the map illustrating bunting distribution. Snow buntings are circumpolar, nesting in the Arctic on the tundra. Mother watches the birds carefully. Tell me, Terry, are these birds Tolstoy may have known? Mother and I met for lunch today. She shared with me the letter she received from her friend Tamara Crocker Pulsifer. It read, Dear Diane, I feel you understand maybe far more than I do about this difficult time. The letter you sent was so good for me, and your constant support of me and my mother have been deeply needed. I've learned a most valuable lesson. Sometimes you have to totally rely on the arms, tears, and loving hearts of others. That is truly where God's love lies, in the support of family and friends. I appreciate the book you sent me and the lotion for my 29th birthday. I really thought I would go gray before I went bald. I wish at times I had more options and choices, but right now I'm torn between the excitement of what I'm learning about life and the sorrow I feel in that I have no future. My beliefs are carrying me, Diane. How exciting to know we will possibly be able to design and create our own worlds as our mother and father in heaven have. I'm starting to forget days now, and often around 4 a.m., my pillow becomes wet with the challenges ahead. I'm crying, Diane. Please, I say, help me laugh, and mean it. Help me find gratitude for the small things I have left. Diane, never before have I wanted to do more, but I can't concentrate on what it is that I want. And then, when I remember, I don't have the strength or the energy to carry it out. I know I want Adrian, Kanace, Christian, Geneva, and mostly just to nurse and hold sweet Adria. How can we be so sad and so full at the same time? I say to myself, be cheerful and don't worry about the future. But then I think about my children. I wish I could interview 100 robust women who had hearts of gold to raise my family and teach them what I have taught them. Maybe next week I'll place an ad in the newspaper. Thank you for your example, Diane. I will love you forever. Tamara. The eye of the cormorant is emerald. The eye of the eagle is amber. The eye of the grebe is ruby. The eye of the ibis is sapphire. 4 gemstones mirror the minds of birds, birds that meditate between heaven and earth. We miss the eyes of birds, focusing only on feathers. Thanks for listening. This is Nancy Williams for the Zesty Garden.